Welcome to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Oman, Assistant Professor at William & Mary Law School. You can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com. Just look on the left side of the page under the Categories heading and click on Law Talk. There you can find past episodes as well as information on how to subscribe. This week we're going to hear from Professor Al Brophy of the University of Alabama Law School. Al's a legal historian, and his work is mainly focused on issues of slavery and race in American law. Most recently, he's been interested in debates over reparations for slavery, and in 2006 he published a book, Reparations Pro and Con, with Oxford University Press on the subject. Our format for this episode is going to be a little bit different. Rather than sitting down and chatting with Al, he gave me permission to share with you a recording of an address that he gave on September 20th, 2007 at William & Mary Law School. The title of Al's address is Considering a University Apology for Slavery, the Case of William & Mary Professor Thomas R. Dew. The address touches on the issues of institutional responsibility, reparations, and apologies for slavery.
August Wilson's play, The Piano Lesson, is about the choices we make to remember history or to seek money to live in the present. Reparations presents a similar set, I think, of problems where we try to come to terms with and remember and overcome the past, but as of right now, I think the issue is really one of whether we can have a memory of the past or not. The Piano Lesson begins with a family that struggles to think, what will they do with a piano that was crafted by their grandfather? Will they sell it in order to reclaim land that they owned and worked, their family worked during the era of slavery, or will they keep the piano to remember their past? I think there's a lot to talk about in the moral case and the need for apologies or reparations. Looking at this picture of the Tulsa riot of 1921 suggests some of them. It's a postcard made up after the riot to commemorate the riot entitled Running the Negro Out of Tulsa, June the 1st, 1921. But what I want to talk with you about is something that we hear much less about, less than the moral case, and that is the sort of the political case. If you look at this poll data, you'll see there is a very, very long way to go. When the Mobile Register in Alabama polled on the issue of reparations for slavery in June 2002, they found that something like 5% of whites were in favor and something like 67% of African Americans were in favor. And I say something like because some people became so enraged at the mere suggestion of reparations that they couldn't complete the poll. Now, why you couldn't put them down as a no, I'm not sure, but there was something about getting an accurate sample size in there. And they found it was the most racially divisive issue they had ever polled on, outstripping even the issue of integration. So I appreciate, I'm glad that you're here and have an open mind on all of these sorts of things, which by definition you do since you're willing to participate in this discussion. There are, of course, some groups that have gotten some form of reparations. Japanese Americans interned during World War II. Others not so well known, the victims of the Armenian Genocide, received modest reparations after the California legislature repealed the statute of limitations for lawsuits against insurance companies that had failed to pay on insurance claims for victims of the genocide. Then there are other less known cases. The joke in Alabama is when we talk about reparations, when will money be paid for the plantations that were burned during the war? Or for the University of Alabama, which, like your institution, was burned by Northern troops during the war. And I say, well, funny you should ask that, because wandering around campus one day, I came across this plaque on Clark Hall that was named for a successful businessman who, among other things, managed the committee, headed up the committee that managed the 46,000 acres of public land Congress gave the institution in reparation for the 1865 destruction of the campus by federal troops. And I was told by Terry Myers, who has done terrific, terrific work on this university's history, that the same is true for William and Mary as well. And despite the proclamations of some people like Richard Epstein that the legal case for reparations is defeated, I think there have been some successful lawsuits. The Hawaiian Trust case, which settled recently for $600 million. And then there is the United Daughters of the Confederacy against Vanderbilt University. It's a complex case. The United Daughters of the Confederacy gave money in the 1930s for a dormitory on the then Peabody College campus. It's now been subsumed by Vanderbilt. And they also had the right to name young women who were descended from the Confederate soldiers to live there for free. Vanderbilt, after it acquired Peabody in the 1970s, stopped the free housing, and then in 2002, it said it was no longer going to call it Confederate Memorial Hall, just Memorial Hall, and the United Daughters of the Confederacy successfully sued on an agreement going back to the 1930s. All of that brings us to issues of what are we thinking about when we're thinking about reparations or apologies, or truth commissions, the sort of more gentle version of this. I think first thing, we're thinking about some kind of public memory and understanding that understands the contributions of African Americans and respects and understands the suffering and disability that is the legacy of the dark years of slavery and Jim Crow. I think we have an exceedingly long way to go in bringing some basic understanding of facts of American history, like the horror that was the institution of slavery, to the public. To take one of many examples, I give you Sewanee, the University of the South, which is currently struggling with its meaning of its connections to the Confederacy. Sewanee has multiple connections. There's a statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the Klan, that was placed on the campus in the early part of the 20th century by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. It has this mace, which was given by a donor in 1965, which features a Confederate battle flag. When the New York Times covered this in November 2005, one outraged alumnus wrote a 60-page, single-spaced manifesto to defend Sewanee. And among the things that he says in defense of Confederate symbols on the campus is that slavery was a benign Christian institution. The Nazis had, I'm quoting, the Nazis had a very different relationship with the Jews than the slave owners had with their legal property, whom they fed, clothed, housed, and lovingly baptized into Christ's redeeming salvation. On the Old South plantation, the master and his lady and servants and field hands constituted an interdependent family community noted for mutual affection and devotion. This, I think, is unfortunately the kind of historical misinformation that we sometimes are dealing with. And it informs and structures how voters, legislators, and judges respond to issues of race. If one thinks of the era of Reconstruction as an era of corrupt African-American politicians and Yankees, then you are unlikely to have a favorable view of the Reconstruction-era amendments, or of the need for federal protection of voting rights, or of the need for civil rights legislation or social programs of any kind, to say nothing of reparations. And in part, I think we have these kinds of histories because of the intellectual machinery that supported Jim Crow. I give you here Thomas Dixon's, the title page of Thomas Dixon's 1905 novel, The Klansman, which was published by Doubleday, which is now owned by Random House. And that, you may be familiar with the more popular version of The Klansman, which was made into a movie by D.W. Griffiths. Here's the movie posters, The Birth of a Nation, founded on Thomas Dixon's novel, The Klansman. How then do we get to a fuller understanding of our history, which I think is what is at the center of much of this talk of apologies, truth commissions, reparations? Sometimes there will be national action. There was the Senate lynching apology a few years ago, proposed apologies to Native Americans, President Clinton's apologies to just about everybody who existed. President Bush's speech at Glory Island in 2003. I think, though, in these kinds of discussions, we need to be very careful. We need to make the moral and political case to be measured in rhetoric and in demand, to make these topics for understanding of the past to look like something that I believe it to be, which is something that is both reasonable and necessary. And sometimes we've had local work. There was the Tulsa Race Riot Commission of 1921 that investigated that tragedy, the 1898 Wilmington, North Carolina Race Riot Commission. Yale students in 2001 undertook a comprehensive self-study. Brown University recently had a very, very comprehensive self-study, and I thought one of the positive things would have showed both the connections of Brown to the institution of slavery as well as to the cause of anti-slavery. And then we have this recent action in 2007. Yale took down this picture, which had until this spring, hung in the room where the trustees meet. It is a picture of Elihu Yale being waited on by, we believe but are not sure, an enslaved boy. He has a metal collar, which is the telltale sign, we believe, of somebody who is enslaved. Yale took it down, though, not because it was a reminder of the era of subordination of African Americans, but because it portrayed their president in an inappropriate light. He actually turns out, or their founder in an inappropriate light. It turns out he did not own anybody, and they did not want to have him associated with the institution of slavery. And so I think in these sorts of revisiting the past, we need to be careful about the acts of both memory and forgetting, because now that the picture is taken down, there I have some fear that there will be less memory on that campus of the era of its of the era of slavery. And then there was last spring the University of Virginia's rather hasty apology for slavery. There are some other ways of thinking about these issues of memory. The state of Virginia provides $5 every year for the maintenance of every Confederate soldier's grave in the state of Virginia. I actually think those kinds of things are appropriate. I am a fan of visiting cemeteries, and I think the preservation of cemeteries is really important. But I think it points up some sort of asymmetries in how we fund and remember the past. And I am not a fan at all of reparations lawsuits. I think when they are poured out by courts, as they almost always and inevitably will be, people will conclude there is no moral case as well as no legal case. However, I do think there is one interesting and provocative lawsuit that one might be interested in pursuing, or at least the rights under which you might pursue this, and that is that there are people who are descended from those buried on private property have a right, an implied easement in gross for you property folks, to visit cemeteries, even if they're on private property. So one of the suggestions I have is to locate slave cemeteries on private property and then request access to those as a way of connecting the past to the present. But all of this brings us to the question that motivates my talk. What role might we think your university, William and Mary, has to play in this debate? And I think it is quite reasonable to begin with the question, what good are truth commissions, investigations of the past, and apologies? Why should we dredge up unpleasant acts from our past? And by talking about a single institution's history and only a piece of that history, don't we run the risk of distorting the past? A discussion for an apology will likely meet two key arguments. First, the current generation is not responsible for prior crimes. And secondly, an apology dishonors the memory of the college or of the South more generally, or at least distorts the role of slavery in the college's history. Such, I think, is a realistic problem at this university, where, for example, William Small taught Thomas Jefferson moral philosophy, and where the humanitarian George Wythe, who was also Jefferson's law teacher, held our country's first chair in law. The Enlightenment ideas taught here, nurtured on this campus, helped free our nation. A leading anti-slavery advocate, lawyer, and judge, St. George Tucker, taught here. Tucker's edition of Blackstone's commentaries, which included his odd proposed plan for the gradual abolition of slavery, was mocked for its optimism and anti-slavery advocacy, including by his son, Nathan Beverly Tucker, who was at that point, when he mocked it in 1835, teaching at this institution. There was a world of possibility that was overwhelmed in the grim years leading into Civil War. and this institution's enormous contributions to the cause of anti-slavery are in danger of being lost amidst talk of slavery at William & Mary. And of course, there is the argument that talk of apologies and truth commissions is divisive. Yet I think when offered in the wake of a thorough historical investigation, they promise a point of reconciliation. There are places where people who've been left outside one of our country's great institutions can be reincorporated. They are part of rebalancing our historical narrative. They offer a form of honesty and a basis for making forward-looking decisions about what corrective action is appropriate. And they remind us of the continuing culpability that we have in the institutions of slavery and, to a greater extent, Jim Crow. Truth commissions and apologies are part of shifting the framework of thinking and discussion, I believe, as well. President Bush's speech at Gory Island in 2003, a main point of embarkation for slave ships bound for the Americas, acknowledged the hard work our country still has ahead. President Bush also cited the progress in our country made possible by the human spirit's desire for freedom. And I suspect President Bush's speech is one product, one offshoot of the movement for apologies for the eras of slavery and Jim Crow. And while some of us may see that as too little, I think it's a positive step in acknowledging the work left to be done and a promise of more work that will be forthcoming. That then brings me to Thomas Roderick Dew, whose portrait I had the pleasure of seeing in the lovely Wren Building this morning as I toured your terrific campus. President Dew is identified on your website as graduate of William & Mary, political economist, educator, author, professor of history and political law. I don't think that begins to do justice to Dew's importance to antebellum thought. He was one of our country's leading pro-slavery theorists in the years leading into Civil War. And what I want to focus with you today, he's the author of a number of important works, Lectures on the Restrictive System, which is a sort of a follow-up on Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. He is the author of a 600-page legal history of Western civilization. I highly recommend it to you, and that's how I became first interested in Dew. It is a stunning work of scholarship, even if we may disagree with basically every premise in it. But what I want to talk to you about is what's called the review of the debate in the Virginia legislature of 1831 and 32. And that review was essentially a several hundred page argument in favor of slavery and against any kind of gradual abolition plan, which the Virginia legislature had considered in the wake of Nat Turner's rebellion in 1831, and which Dew not only wrote about but was an active opponent of the gradual abolition plan in the legislature in 1831 and 1832. William and Mary law professor Beverly Tucker told students at this institution that in this reading age, he who writes a people's books need not care who makes their laws. And I think Dew is an excellent proof of that phenomenon. For over several hundred pages, Dew supports the institution of slavery. I think it's a fascinating counter move to classic works that undermine order and hierarchy, like Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which began by delegitimizing the British crown. You'll recall Paine said, a French bastard landing with an armed banditti and establishing himself as King of England against the consent of the natives hath no divinity in it. Dew began by legitimizing slavery. He saw it as a step on the way towards civilization. And he has much talk of enlightenment, reason. And he tries to slow emancipation talk in action by simply noting that slavery will require enormous and likely, in his words, insurmountable effort to end. The evil of yesterday's growth may be extirpated today and the vigor of society may heal the wound, but that which is the growth of ages may require ages to remove. He saw emancipation plans as increasing problems, increasing misery. The great question of abolition can easily be shown to be utterly subversive of the interests, security, happiness that of both blacks and whites, and consequently hostile to every principle of expediency, morality, and religion. The triumvirate of terms he keeps employing. slavery, far from wrong, was the cause of civilization, for it gradually fells the forest and thereby destroys the haunts of the wild beasts. It gives rise to agricultural production and thereby renders mankind less dependent on the precarious and diminishing production. It converts the idler and wanderer into the man of business and the agriculturalist. What are the causes of civilization among the Cherokees? Dew asks, why the adoption of slavery, of course, which allowed the tribes to indulge their natural, what he refers to as their natural laziness. It's an extraordinary acknowledgement of the benefits that slavery conferred on a people, the ability to have someone else labor for them. But here as elsewhere, Dew rails against those who say all men are born equal. Slavery in the abstract is wrong, and the slave has a natural right to regain his set of liberty. No set of legislators, he thought, ever can or have legislate upon purely abstract principles, entirely independent of circumstances, without the ruin of the body politic. And so he turns to the total impracticality of abolition. The mere discussion of abolition threatens further revolutions like Nat Turner's and the one that rocked Haiti and won freedom for the people enslaved there in the 1790s. And then he returns at the end of the book to the supposed evils of slavery. But far from evil, he says, the benefits to the enslaved as well as the enslaveholder. And he says, we have no doubt, but that the slaves form the happiest portion of our society. A merrier being does not exist on the face of the globe than the Negro of the slave of the United States. In Dew's 1836 address to the Virginia Historical Society, he returned to those themes. Expediency, morality, and religion alike demand slavery's continuance, and perhaps I will not hazard too much in the prediction that the day will come when the whole Confederacy will be regarded as the sheet anchor of our country's liberty. And then, in something that I think is particularly apt for you folks, in his inaugural lecture here in 1836, he told students at William & Mary about the special place they occupied in Virginia Slave Society and the role their education could play in helping them defend slavery. You are slaveholders or the son of slaveholders, and as such, your duties and responsibilities are greatly increased. He who governs and directs the actions of others need especially intelligence and virtue. Then can we exhibit to the world the most convincing evidence of justice to our cause. Then may we stand up with boldness and confidence against the frowns of the world. And if the demon of fanaticism shall at last array its thousands of deluded victims against us, threatening to involve us in universal ruin by overthrow of our institutions, we may rally under principles undivided and undismayed. And still, I think we need to have some sense of what this means for us, really for you. I am just an interloper here. I am just an outside troublemaker. For as William & Mary law professor Judge Beverly Tucker told graduating students in 1847, William & Mary is what Virginia made her. Virginia continues what she is in part because the spirit of her ancient chivalry continues to act on her through William & Mary. Each at once cause and effect, and each is necessary to the other. He asked of William & Mary students, only a love of truth and a sense of honor, these are all she asks in evaluating arguments. And so I think the world or the rest of us leave it to the goodwill and the wisdom of the students, faculty, administration, and alumni of this school to consider the wisdom and efficacy of further investigations of this great institution's past and its implications for our country's future.
I'm always interested in your responses to Law Talk. You can email me at nbomann@wm.edu. You've been listening to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. Technical support is provided by William & Mary Law School. Our theme music was written and performed by John Schmidt. You can find more of John's work online at www.johnschmidt.com. That's J-O-N. And you can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com.